Leslie Golden was a pole dancer in small-town Texas with a teeny Instagram following, until a whirlwind weekend in L.A. where she blew up online. From there, she entered a new world, one where partying in L.A. mansions, jet-setting to Thailand, and getting glammed up for brand campaigns was all part of a day's work. Leslie is just one of many influencers who got famous on the internet and then tried to flip that clout into a whole new life. On This Blew Up, I'm going to show you how social media stardom is made, from the SponCon to the content houses, and how it all adds up to a new kind of fame that's not always as glamorous as it looks. When attention is the ultimate currency, what lengths will you go to get it? And who's going to want a piece of your success? From the Ringer Podcast Network, I'm Alyssa Bereznak. You can listen to This Blew Up on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
I need sports staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, Mon Mothma's political donation super bundler, it's Andy Greenwald.
Okay, so you're referencing Andor, my favorite show on television.
I sure am.
You're also referencing Democratic fundraising emails, which are my favorite topic to discuss. And, you know, what do you think they're like in the Star Wars galaxy? Because right now I'm getting stuff that is just so wild. Every 4 years, or I guess every 2 years, it gets crazier.
Every two years? I get them every, 2 minutes.
No, I get them every 2 minutes, but I'm saying, every 2 years, the floor of crisis rises slightly.
You should check your updates folder in Gmail. They never stop coming, even when it's just we know we've won the Senate, but we still need your support.
I just feel like Mark Kelly in Arizona has been leveling with me, Andrew, for a minute now. And I don't know what else there is to say. You know, my guy Adam Schiff, my rep, proud to have him be my rep. I'm like, you're fine, buddy. I know democracy isn't,
Andy, it's
but
me,
you
pencil
are
neck.
Fine.
Remember when he was, whatever Trump used to call him, pencil neck?
Yeah.
What a fucking planet we live on. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you today?
Good. We're going to talk about Andor. I want to talk to you a little bit about James Gunn becoming the co-CEO of the DC Universe.
And I want to talk to you about declining that position, which I thought was a really, really big bet on yourself.
That's true. I was trying I want to come up with my own original IP universe of superheroes. Nobody's backing me.
Bro, you're holding out for co-head of the Valiant Comics expanded universe, or Malibu Comics, a bunch of things from the 90s that only you can bring to the screen.
What's going on with you? It's Thursday. Any news on your front?
Well, I think there's a couple things coming off the transom. One, you know, I'm as eager as anyone to continue to litigate the House of the Dragon finale. A couple points that I just found on the back of my scratch pad. No, I did want to say it was brought to my attention that I misgendered Emma Darcy, who plays Rhaenyra, grown-up Rhaenyra, right, on the show. That is completely an oversight and a mistake on my part. Emma Darcy uses they, them pronouns. That's something I probably should have been aware of, and I was not. So I apologize for that, and I will do better going forward.
Yeah, and I apologize as well.
But thank you for bringing that to our attention. And second point is, there was some chatter I know that my name appeared in a Hollywood Reporter story that came out this week.
Yes, you bought Twitter.
I bought... Wait, you just stepped on it.
is it too soon?
My first move is I'm going to give Rembert Brown a blue check mark.
Okay.
And then I'm done. That's why I bought it. No, so there was a Hollywood Reporter story. I cannot confirm or deny any aspect of that article. But one thing that came out of it that I always feel, I don't always feel, but I occasionally feel the need to address is whatever it may say about my objectivity or my, I believe the word shilling was used, not in reference to the British coin when this article dropped. Look, here's all I can say.
Somebody said you were shilling? Where do you get most of your feedback from these days? Facebook or what's
Well, I get most of my news from Facebook. And I can't believe what President Eric Holder is doing from behind the scenes.
Yeah.
So that takes up a lot of my time. A lot of my time. Also, one of my favorite things about Facebook News, just a great reputable news source I really recommend.
What are doing with your time?
I just do this to wind you up. But every so often, every third story is basically just People Magazine's cover this week. And it's like Ashley Judd on grief, trauma, breaking her leg, and why people say she looks different now. And I'm like, click, you earned it. You earned it. Anyway, just to say, you know, it's an interesting thing. Like, I don't think this has ever been an objective reportage podcast. I feel like it's always been a personality driven, at least on your part. And I just try to keep up.
You think I'm the engine, the personality engine of this podcast?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. If this was a morning zoo type show, you would be the host and I would be the whack pack.
Oh, I disagree. I mean? I think I'm like the George Hill. I'm like the steady game manager point guard who just hits you in the chest with a pass and then screens away.
Did you just switch to the NBA?
Yeah.
Did you just immediately grab hold of the metaphor and just bring it back to a safe place?
Yes.
Anyway, we do criticism and we do commentary and we talk about chicken recipes. And once I stopped being a written critic and started working to the best of my abilities within the industry, there were always going to be some conflicts of interest. We've tried to keep as straight a moral compass on these issues as possible. You know, at the time when I was making Briar Patch and I was under an overall deal at Universal, we would advertise, we would say that was public knowledge. The thing is, this is an era of consolidation and a lot of stuff. So not talking about Universal things started to feel a little bit impossible. So we started to talk about some Universal
Did we really
things.
Try not to talk about Universal shows?
I did, or I tried to put in a New York Times,
So that's why at the top of the rundown when I would be we need to address Universal and their
No. moves. You would be like, Christopher Maloney's silence on the continued expansion of the Law and Order universe is becoming
it will
a
not
problem.
Stand.
And I'd
it
be like, I can't go with you on that.
Those were some weird episodes.
Those were really weird. A lot of silence on my end, on the whack pack.
A lot of me talking about SVU into the void.
Your crisp chest passes flying into the stands.
God damn it, Olivia.
Oh, this is just like a participation trophy if all victims are special. That was your whole thing, right? So anyway, I guess all of this is to say, I do my best. If you have listened for the last 10 weeks as we've covered House of the Dragon, you know I'm not good at hiding my true feelings about things. I can't really lie or pretend to have an opinion that I don't have. I'm just not good at it. I am, I do have a career as a screenwriter and producer and take meetings with probably most of the companies and streamers that we talk about. I don't feel it's been compromised. My opinions or my presence on the podcast has been compromised because of it. And, in relation to this particular bit of shilling, I think you should go back and listen to our Obi-Wan podcasts. Those stand. Those are on the public record. Those are on the public record, and I regret nothing. So anyway, that's my bit. You want to come at me?
I don't have anything to add because you guard your secrets so closely. You know what I mean? Take your contractual obligations so seriously that this is all news to me. So I don't even know what you're referring to because I also get my news from Facebook. So it's been a real just feeling out in the dark what you're doing. No, I think that I would also just stress that you and I feel differently about House of the Dragon. Like, you disliked the show and had a lot of concerns about it. And while I did not love it, I certainly enjoyed it. And I certainly found a lot to talk about in it. And you know, there's a variety of different ways that you can approach and talk about television shows. And as far as your reference to your other like gigs out there, I've never found you to be like somebody who pulls punches. And that's why today Andor, we're putting it on the stand because it's completely fallen off. Tony Gilroy, turn in your WGA card, sir.
This is all a smokescreen to hide the fact that Chris is actually the showrunner of the Jon Snow spinoff.
The funny thing is that like, well, no, it's not that funny. So in any case, yes, Andy, that was you really put that well. I hope that people continue to trust you as the moral North Star that you've always been.
Or don't trust me at all. I mean, or think that I'm full of it. Whatever, that's fine. This is a podcast. Free-flowing exchange of ideas and chess passes.
Let's test this a little bit by talking about Hollywood. So over the last couple of days, it was announced that James Gunn, director of Guardians of the Galaxy and, among other things, Suicide Squad, or The Suicide Squad, right? He didn't direct the one without that James Gunn and Peter Safran were going to take over basically the DC Comics cinematic universe over at Warner Brothers. Walter Hamada, who had a very tumultuous, if I suppose financially lucrative and successful tenure as sort of head of DC over there.
Side note, Aquaman made $1 billion. I think about this every day now.
The proof's in the
pudding.
$1 billion. Yeah. He is exiting stage left, and they were looking for somebody to come in and be the Kevin Feige of DC. They've been looking for this person for a while. They got down the line a couple of times. Maybe Michael DeLuca and Pamela Abdi were just going to run it as they're under their sort of umbrella of running Warner Brothers movies anyway. Yada, yada. And then out of nowhere...
Dan Lin was rumored Dan Lin to be was, at the like paperwork stage of it.
Yes.
Dan Lin is a prolific producer who has a big deal with Warner Brothers for his Rideback Studios. He produced the Lego movies, etc.
Oh, so then Dan Lin is your favorite producer. Oh, wait, you don't like the Lego movies, right?
I love the Lego movies.
Oh, okay. Anyway, so James Gunn takes over. It's kind of an almost throwback story in some ways. It was more like coming out of New Hollywood and the formation of like, you know, American zoetrope. I mean, it's not like that, but it's very rare that you see a director of James Gunn's profile take on an executive level. Not like just like, I'm executive producing this. You can say it's executive produced by Steven Spielberg or Martin Scorsese. Like every day hustling, taking calls, running meetings, James Gunn will be running the DC universe. It's obviously a very cool challenge for him. I personally do not like DC Comics, cinematic universe movies, like generally. I liked the Nolan movies. I thought there were parts of the Matt Reeves Batman that I liked. But for the most part, like the Black Adam, Aquaman,
Chris,
Justice League.
We didn't really talk about that Batman. Were the parts of that movie you liked the parts where it was dark and raining?
No, I thought that there was cool stuff in the Batman. I just did not need to be 3 hours. But it speaks to an interesting moment where James Gunn's arriving. And while you could say DC is in flux and like there is really no plan, that doesn't mean that there aren't successful movies that are kind of in process, you know, so in the process of being made or released or developed. So on one hand, you've got this sandbox that you can play in and you can make the rules of the sandbox. On the other hand, Black Adam was just released, relatively successful movie. The Batman was a very successful movie. The Joker, which has got a sequel coming, is also happening. So you've got multiple Jokers, you've got multiple... basically like realities within this cinematic universe. And then you've got the desire that I think everybody has if they were going to be put in a position like this is to rebuild this entire thing in your image and like set the tone, set the visual language, recast all these parts, build this up again. Because part of what I think maybe propelled Marvel into the permanent pop culture consciousness is the fantasy Marvel League aspect of it, of being... Mm-hmm. very actively a participant in what's coming and like who's going to get cast as this person and are they going to show up at the end of WandaVision and all that stuff, which I think really does make people feel like they're more than just movie fans, that they're actually like along for the ride as these movies get made. You have to have a plan to do that. So I guess I was going to ask you if you have any general thoughts on this, but I have a follow-up question that's a little bit more of a sort of general question.
My first thought was I read the headline very quickly, and I thought that James Gunn and novelist Jonathan Safran Foer were taking over the DC universe, which, into it. Honestly, into it. Why not?
Yeah.
Why not? Try something new. I laughed when I saw the headline, and I was a little bit puzzled and taken aback by it. And I've come all the way around 180 degrees. I think this is a great idea. And the reason I think it's a great idea, you sort of touched on it about the idea of having a vision. And I think that having that vision be one that is creative, not just managerial, is a very, very good premise to begin from.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Feige gets all the credit he gets now because of the entrepreneurial and financial juggling act that he basically performed to knit. You don't juggle and knit. Let me start over with my analogy. This is why I have a very successful Hollywood screenwriting career, by the way. Master of the metaphor. He stitched together all of these things and created this like tapestry of content that has blanketed us, frankly. Mm-hmm. That one worked out in the end. I was glad about that. But at the beginning, I think what made him so, so crucial and so visionary was that he deeply in his bones understood each of these Marvel characters and the appeal of them in a way that was reducible to a log line that could be translated to a broader audience who couldn't understand why a Norse god they maybe read about in college was getting his own movie.
Mm-hmm.
That was the genius, right? And I think that DC has tried it this way before. The successful comics writer Geoff Johns was running this division for a while. Jim Lee, who's a brilliant and long, you know, for many, many decades now, comic book artist, was involved on this side of things. The Walter Hamadas and the Dan Lins of the world, who are creative and talented and smart people, a prediction may have been that had they found success, Hamada did find some success, but Dan Lin's success may have been similar to Hamada's in the sense that whatever worked was their North Star. They would be chasing the box office returns of the last movie as opposed to communicating a larger vision for what these characters and this property can be in more than just the global marketplace, right? Mm-hmm. And so the thing about James Gunn, like whether you like his movies or dislike his movies, and I've done both, I don't think he, as a longtime consumer of comic books and pop culture, necessarily is just the movies he makes. Like, I think that when he reads, again, I don't know him, I'm just assuming here, but because he's a comic book reader of a certain age, my guess is that when he reads Grant Morrison comics or Alan Moore comics, he likes and appreciates them, maybe even loves them, even though those aren't his wheelhouse.
And then
things.
Alan Moore is like, thanks for liking and appreciating my work. It means a lot.
One thing that Alan Moore is famous for is loving Hollywood attention. Great point. I say this because when they're announced as the head of these movies, I don't think that means that the next 10 years is going to be Hawkman kidnaps Kevin Bacon, which is, you know, what we're going to talk about his James Gunn's Marvel things in a second. I think that what it might mean is some space to hold the totality of the DC universe, which again, not even as a very, very casual fan of it throughout my life, contains the absolute self-serious, weighty stuff that has come to the screen and absolute golden age and silver age insanity that he tried to weave into the Suicide Squad, right? So I feel like there's a space for a different type of storytelling and a kind of whole 360 degree embrace of everything that DC is. That's my hope for it. And the secondary piece of news that gives me some hope is that also this week, Henry Cavill announced, you know, or confirmed, I guess the Black Adam mid credits tease confirmed it, right? That he's coming back as Superman. And the headlines that were all over Facebook, my number one news gathering source, had a word in it that has not been associated with his portrayal of Superman or the role of Superman in the DC universe for the last, you know, since the Richard Donner movies, which was joy.
Mm-hmm.
That really stood out to me. It stood out to me that maybe there will be
in what context was joy being used?
Well, I think he was saying it was a joy to be able to announce, a joy to return to this part, et cetera. But I interpreted that to me. Maybe this is just my own hopefulness that we might see a version of Superman that has always existed in media, but not for the last 20 years, which is a hopeful character,
mm-hmm.
right? Just something a little bit different than the kind of pummeling world destruction of the Zack Snyder movie. So I guess broadly, I think it's cool. I think it's cool that creatives are get put in charge of this. And I don't think it necessarily means it's all just going to be, you know, exploding head jokes. I just think I don't know the guy, but I think it's remarkable. By the way, it's also just a remarkable ascent because
yeah,
I first became aware of him. He was married to Jenna Fischer from The Office when The Office broke. And I remember, like, I don't know whether this was on websites or magazine articles being like, oh, Jenna Fischer's with her husband who makes like Roger Corman.
Yeah, he makes like creature features.
With like porn stars and things. And it's just like, then he went mainstream and then he got excommunicated for tweets. And then he's not only back in the mainstream, now he's this sagacious silver fox who's being handed the keys to a $1 billion empire. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, so there was a couple of little notes I wanted to make. One is that it's a 4-year deal, apparently.
Okay.
But Kevin Feige had a reaction when they asked him at the Wakanda Forever premiere, like, oh, what do you think of this news? He's like, it's great. He's busy with us until next May. So it's like, it's a 3.5-year deal.
That is very, very much true.
I would also say that one of the things that Gunn is good at, even if you are like, I can take or leave his sense of humor or his sensibility, is Guardians was not a obvious home run pick of characters to develop. The story essentially goes that like Feige was like, would love to work with you. What might you want to do? And yep, he was like, Guardians. And I think that they were basically like, who, what now? Like, who are the Guardians of the Galaxy? And like, they had to actually like go back and be like, okay. And it turns out whether you are into or not into the Marvel pivot to the cosmos, it essentially gave that franchise like a new lease on life.
Because, oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for as much as we tease and laugh about like the Civil War and like you guys thought you were making parallax view stuff with the Russos, like they probably did need to pivot away from the Slovenia Accords, Slovakia. What the fuck was that place called?
When the great William Rhodes, aka Battle Machine, saved the world in the Slovenian Accords.
Yeah. Slovenia. I watch a lot of Luka Doncic, so I have Slovenia on the mind. Yeah.
Luka Doncic plays as if a supervillain lifted up his home country and dropped it back down onto Earth. I mean, he does have that kind of chip on his shoulder. I'm glad you made those points because this isn't necessarily the work of today's podcast or even our podcast generally, but it's an interesting question as to like, what is the most, in terms of what Marvel became and what Marvel is now, what is the most significant film in retrospect for that pivot? And I think unquestionably it's 2014 is the year when it happened. Mm-hmm. But 2014 is the year that Guardians of the Galaxy was released and also Captain America Winter Soldier was released. And I think we've spent a lot of time pointing to, you referenced, you know, the Russo brothers being like, we're making parallax view and what that gave to the franchise and to the larger MCU in terms of more, you know, I don't know, if it wasn't a grounded stakes, but definitely kind of real world stakes, such as they are, that led through to Civil War and to everything that followed. You could make the case, and maybe I will today, that Guardians of the Galaxy is far more significant in terms of expanding the larger MCU project and extending the life of it.
Sure.
Because as you said, it's outrageous that movie got made and that it worked. It is a very successful, very enjoyable, very fun movie. And as Marvel's gotten bigger and bigger, and this helps segue into the trailers that we wanted to talk about today before we get to Andor, it's just gotten purpler, green screenier,
mm-hmm,
and just further and further away from Earth, because how many times can you threaten Earth? And by the way, I just a moment ago referred to something that I hate, which is Zack Snyder literally destroying Earth. So
right.
I'm not arguing against this, but the introduction of randomness, of goofiness, of comedy, and of outer space, all of that is where we are now, right? That seems much more relevant to the Marvel project than Gary Shandling is secretly a Hydra agent. Sorry,
yes.
Spoilers.
The one thing I wanted to ask you before we got into some of those Marvel trailers, though, is let's say you were James Gunn. And let's say you were given these keys. Is day one, sweep everything off of the table, erase the whiteboard, and start from zero? Or are you like, I understand that there's the Matt Reeves verse, there's mm-hmm. the Dwayne Johnson Black Adam verse, which I guess Henry Cavill is a part of. J.J. Abrams was developing a Superman movie with Ta-Nehisi Coates. There's you know, multiple Jokers and multiple TV shows and multiple this and multiple that? And do you try to basically find a middle ground where you develop just good movies throughout and have a sort of quality control on DC movies in general, but not necessarily try to tell one story over the course of multiple phases over the course of multiple years? Or is this a once in a lifetime opportunity and you say, we're stripping it down. Everything that's ever happened in DC now has got a line drawn under it. And it's like, that didn't happen. And we're starting at zero with a new Superman and a new Batman and a new Joker and a new this. And we're going to build the story out slowly. I have to admit, I probably imagine that what he's doing is he's like, there are a lot of non-Justice League DC stories to tell.
Yes.
That I want to go find and that I want to go bring to the screen.
I think that's probably right. I think that this is a potentially useful inflection point for everything they've done, because, you know, the CW is slowly shifting what it is. HBO Max has been shifting, not shifting in terms of, like, you know, Titans season four is coming. The Harley Quinn cartoon is there. Like, but, you know, they went through a period of tumult when David Zaslav took over Warner Discovery. I don't think so. There's an opportunity to either just, you know, bring to a close, wrap up some of that stuff, like the Berlanti Arrowverse, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think historically I am that aligned with David Zaslav on a lot of things, but I do think that the point, either the point he made or as it was communicated through the press, that these DC characters are one of the crown jewels of this Warner media empire and need to be treated with a little bit more reverence or specialness. I don't think that's wrong. I think that the idea of, like, Michael Keaton coming back to be Batman again for a straight to TV Batgirl movie, which may have been good. You know, we're not going to relitigate that.
Right.
But I kind of understand the sense that it was all becoming a little bit, it was just too much of it. And it was a little bit too easy to access. I get that. I also think if you read his quotes, whether he said this verbatim or this is how it was interpreted, the idea that he wanted to find a Feige suggests that he thinks the real value in this is a enormous integrated cinematic superhero experience, not just we'll take the wins where we can on the margins of these various different things.
Right.
Now, all of that said, what's the thing that Feige did better than anything? He started with a one good movie and one perfect piece of casting, right? There was no one all these Marvel characters were available basically to make movies out of since they were invented in the 60s by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko. People understood that Spider-Man was probably one of the best, if not the best superhero ever, or that the X-Men were popular forever. No one would have been like, Iron Man's the guy.
Yeah.
But Feige
very few people would have been like, Downey's Iron Man.
Yeah. And Feige made his entire career on those two bets and pulling that one off right. And Jon Favreau, you know, was the right guy to make it, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the real win here would be, I don't know. Is it Hawkman? I don't know. Who cares? But, like, is it the Martian Manhunter? Like, you find the character and you find the most pure creative take and you make a good movie.
Right.
Show me that you make a good movie and then you build slowly from there. The other thing I'll say is that multiversal storytelling, very mainstream now.
Yeah.
Very mainstream. People understand it. And DC invented that.
And I know that the Flash is supposed to be the skeleton key that's, like, now all of this can be happening at once. And there can be multiple actors playing multiple parts, multiple actors playing the same part in different universes. I get it.
And all of this came from the fact that DC as a company was so old. They had a character that was called Green Lantern and a character called Sandman and a character called Flash, et cetera, that were completely different from what other versions of those characters, in the case of Sandman, not even comparable, what they became. And in the 80s, they had this enormous crossover called Crisis on Infinite Earths that tried to unite that, basically erase the alternate versions or confront them and deal with that jumbled history that was never meant to be a history. So in its DNA, DC understands the job of, quote, trying to clean up previous regimes' experiences experimenting, right?
Sure.
So, yeah, I think there's an opportunity here. But what's funny is you just mentioned The Flash, and I was like, I completely forgot about that. Like, that is... And I feel like for a while they wanted us to forget about that.
Sure. Right?
And so that's on their plate. Although maybe Jim Gunn will be like, sorry, I'm busy until May. And I think The Flash is coming out before then.
Yeah, that might be a very convenient contractual obligation. Well, did you want to say anything about Ant-Man or the Guardians Christmas special?
I do. I'll just say one other thing. James Gunn is good with the media and good at quotes and good at communicating things. And part of the job, I think, that this is going to... Part of the job is going to be explaining why there are three Jokers in terms of a larger creative vision, right? Or explaining why this movie exists and why it doesn't and what the larger big picture is. And I feel like having someone who is used to being in front of microphones and is kind of a, you know, popular, if not celebrity figure himself, being the person doing that is probably good for that company.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
Even if they don't have like concrete answers. So, but as you were saying, he's busy. So we saw the first trailer drop for the Guardians of the Galaxy Christmas special, which seems fun. I'm into these special presentations. We
talked
really
about
like
werewolves. Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah. It's a really smart use of a streaming service. You know,
it's also a bizarre use of like international movie star Chris Pratt being like, I guess I'm just going to do this 40-minute Christmas thing about how I'm sad and Kevin Bacon is going to help. Like it is such a weird reflection of New Hollywood, but okay, why not? That seems fun. I mean, I like Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm into it. The other trailer that dropped, speaking of tonal shifts, is this Ant-Man 3 Quantumania trailer that within the trailer tries to handhold you through this franchise's evolution from it's Paul Rudd and we're all having a good time to, oh, this is the new Thanos and Right. Everything matters. It's a wild journey.
So in this Ant-Man trailer,
yeah,
they're all standing around. I can't remember why. They're basically, they build like a satellite or a radio device.
Cassie builds a quantum beacon to send a little, how you doing?
Are all Marvel trailers and all Marvel movies going to start with, I built this thing, or like, I asked you to do something that was silly, and then it turns out that I unleashed hell on Earth. Like, is that essentially the inciting event for all these movies now? Because it's the same story as Spider-Man, right? Where he's just like,
do you think Doctor Strange? Can go back?
And Doctor Strange, right?
Doctor Strange was like, remember the subtitle of that was Never Let a Woman Read a Book. Like that's, I didn't make that up. I stole that, but that, I think it's right.
Who did you steal it from? Walter Hamada?
Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, actually. Yeah, I mean, it's patently absurd because they're just standing around having done something riotously stupid. And Michelle Pfeiffer, who, by the way, radiant, she's like, this is a bad idea, but I feel like she could have said it a few clicks earlier.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I understand. There's something a little bit sad to me watching Michael Douglas and Michelle Pfeiffer surf in front of a green screen into the quantum verse.
I wanted to ask about this. Like, I don't usually watch movies or TV and wish that I was there, you know, because set can be boring or whatever. But like, to be with those legends, while their job is to be like, stay at the Omni or the Four Seasons, I guess, because they're famous in Atlanta for 6 weeks and just be like, we're on an ant now. Whoa.
Yeah.
Like, that's so crazy. You know what I mean? Like, Michael Douglas, didn't he produce One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Yeah. Like, I was just watching The China Syndrome the other day. I was like, this is a good movie.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's just, we should appreciate this moment, right? Like, this is just bizarre. There was a thing I saw on, what's the social media service I use? And it was like, Pablo Picasso, there was a moment when Picasso and Eminem were alive at the same time. I kind of feel that way about Michael Douglas and the second iteration of Kang.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
All that just being like, said.
Yeah.
Majors is the most excited I've been for a performer in these movies in a long time. Essentially since Downey.
It's awesome. It's awesome. It's like, you know, this was just such a canny signing. You know, they were like, this is our guy. We believe in his talent.
You talk about like the like you catch lightning in a bottle. Like they caught lightning in a bottle. Downey obviously had been in Chaplin. Like he was a known quantity. He was just that quantity was very combustible and nobody knew whether or not he could handle this. And, you know, Majors has been in a couple of like smaller films, I guess, but like, you know, is really much more of a bet for the future. But like anybody who's ever seen him in anything is like, who the fuck is that guy?
I also
can't stop looking at him. And he had one scene in Loki and essentially stole the series.
And I love the, this is maybe a small thing, but I love that he's young and that the villain is young. Like, I think that these villain roles, with good reason, often go to more esteemed or established actors with a certain gravitas or experience that they bring with them. So you're used to being afraid of them or falling silent when they walk onto the screen. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's kind of how casting works. But to cast someone who is young and lean and kind of like a live wire, and you don't know what you're getting for a part that specifically, by the way, you don't know what you're getting, because as others have noted, he appears in this trailer and in this movie as Kang the Conqueror, the villain from the Marvel comics, and also ostensibly the villain for the next big phase of leading up to more Avengers movies. That's not the same character he played in Loki. He played a time variant version of Kang. So it was a different vibe. And this is an actor who can do that. I think it's cool. It does seem, I'm not concerned about Ant-Man Quantumania, but it's just like, it is interesting when they grab the crossfader and they're like, this was one of our fun ones. You know, the first Ant-Man movie was almost like, I mean, they willed it across the finish line, right? That it was a
heist movie. It was supposed to be a heist comedy.
But it was also an after effect from the earlier Feige era where he was like, let's take meetings. And I want to work with James Gunn. What do you want to do? I want to work with Edgar Wright. What do you want to do? Ant-Man? Okay, we will do Ant-Man only because you want to do it. And then it was one of the first tests of, I don't know if it's his ego or his mettle, but he was like, we lost Edgar Wright, but we're still going to make this movie. But anyway, now pulling the tab over to the right, being like, this is going to be the bridge movie from the fun one between the serious ones to the inciting incident for the next 5 years of serious ones. It's heavy.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and it's an interesting gambit because you wonder whether or not there was really more Ant-Man story to tell, you know, after two of them. So to have used the third one to be the door to the rest of this makes it kind of must-see TV. You know, or a must-see movie experience, because you're like, I guess I gotta go. I'm going to see this for Kang. I don't know if I needed to go see Paul Rudd have like quips for 2 hours.
I mean, I'm never mad at that. I also think there does seem to be some Daddington content here, right? gotta go get your little girl in the quantum zone.
Is that all it takes?
Oh God, it's all it takes. It's so predictable and so basic. Yeah, it's all it takes.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com. This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear, especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, VURI.com/Simmons.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Would you describe Narkeena 5, the most recent episode of Andor, as Daddington content?
In that there are no Momingtons allowed on this penal colony? And I mean that in all senses.
I'm very excited to talk to you about this. This new episode of Andor that came out on Wednesday, and it's written by Bo Willimon, who wrote House of Cards, at least the first few seasons, and Ides of March, which is a movie based on his play, which I think is quite good. And Toby Haynes directed it. It's basically split into the first half details Cassian's sort of orientation at the Narkeena 5 prison, and then the second half ties together a lot of the narrative threads from the season, including Mon Mothma raising funds for the rebellion and Bix dealing with the fallout of Cassian's activities on Ferrix, and Vel and Cinta looking for Cassian on Ferrix and also dealing with like sort of what their relationship is. And then it kind of wraps up with Luthen trying to raise a rebellion essentially and unite various factions of the rebellion. And he does so by talking with Forrest Whitaker's Saw character, who we saw in Rogue One. This episode was sick again. The show, I love how you can, when you watch these three episode arcs or four episode arcs or whatever you want to say they are, and you can kind of feel your own sort of rising action happening. You're like, I know that the next episode is this, and I know that the next episode has got to be this. What did you think of episode eight?
This episode was sick. This show rules. This show is so purely good in ways that blow my mind week to week to week. And I gotta say, I saw
you would say that, wouldn't you?
Well, right, exactly. I'm proud to say it, and I'll go further. Hold on, let me just check my Zelle. Okay, yeah. You hear that little ding in the background? I'll go further. I saw in like some trades,
you have
basically
new
being
funds
like
from Bob Chapek.
You see Chapek's headline today? JPEG not concerned with having people like him. I was like,
no, did you see the real content that he provided us? I was going to save this for like a very special episode.
Yeah.
He was like, at the end of the day, when parents put their kids to bed, they don't want to watch animation.
That is meaningful for you.
Yes.
Because you feel that way all the time.
Well, because if I don't have to put kids to bed, I never have to watch animation. You know
the
what
idea?
I mean?
The idea of you being like, my job is to put kids to bed.
No, that's why I don't have children.
Super Blumhouse.
It's like
you could do it.
I have destroyed my family line so that I don't have to watch Bluey.
That is legendary.
Yeah. True Viserys shit right there.
It really is. That's some Targaryen shit. I saw in some one of the industry newsletters basically being like, you know, the ongoing bet on Star Wars or whatever is, you know, it's TBD because Andor is obviously expensive and flashy.
There was an article
flashy,
in Puck by Julia Alexander that was about how Andor is, by the metrics that are available, quite clearly the least watched of the Disney Plus shows. And you could make the argument is probably one of the less popular Star Wars releases over the years.
So let me make something clear. Why is everybody fucking Peter Thiel here? You aren't the Walt Disney Company. We don't cheer for ratings. You know what I mean? Like, no, I'm just saying the quality of this program is so outrageously high that that's enough for right now. Like, I know we talk about the industry, but it does bother me.
I would be much less zen about this if it was like in any way whether the second season was a debate, was up for debate. If it hadn't been like, we've signed on, it's 24 episodes, sure. I start shooting season two in November, which is what Tony said to us, then I would be like, if it hadn't been that, I would be like, fuck, I hope they get to finish telling the story.
I get that. And I'm mixing a bunch of stuff into the same pot. But I do want to push back a little bit on this idea that success is purely driven by the marketplace. Like, it's not the case. I don't think the show needs my intellectual charity here either. I think it's doing fine. And I think Hold on, let me just check my balance. We're good.
You that, have funds from Alderaan. Yeah.
That the heist was me. I was in the inside. I did the Aldani heist. I just think it's good for the franchise, and I think it's good for creativity. And I think, honestly, I think it's good for TV, because the thing about this show that boggles my mind week to week, and this episode is the best, in some ways, the best yet in terms of how, as an exemplar of this. I didn't have to be this good. The level of detail, the commitment to showing me things that I haven't seen before, and also just, okay, here, let me throw out something to you that I just can't stop thinking about in this episode. I want to talk about everything regarding the prison planet and the floor and all of the ideas behind it. I want to talk about how, once again, the Tony Gilrovian like sensibility, where everything that you are told or that you're presented with isn't quite what it is, right? That this isn't a jail, it's a factory, but it's also a game. Mm-hmm. And in fact, kind of looks like Squid Game. And I wonder if they were, if Luke Hull was a little concerned about that when that dropped after this was probably already designed. There's a moment when Cashin is on the transport, the prison transport, to take him to this, what's it called? I don't have it in front of me.
Narkina 5. Yeah.
Narkina 5. And they have to kick their shoes off and they're suddenly bolted in, or they're handcuffed in. And it's coming, the ship is lowering itself towards the, I don't even know what it is, the facility. Mm-hmm. And you see the whirlpools and everything underneath it. It's incredibly cool visual. The security guard, or the guard on the transport, grabs hold of the rail like it's the G train stopping short of Hoyt-Schermerhorn Street.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I don't remember seeing that before. I just don't remember. In space travel, Interstellar, it's always like, press a button, the lights blur, and we're there. It got bumpy. The dude had to hold on. Everything in this show is thought about and considered, and you're there. And I love it.
Go one up in the same scene.
Yeah.
They're all wearing different sandals and shoes.
Yes, and each one are, yeah, totally.
And each one is probably like culturally relevant to wherever this person is coming to this prison from. And we're never going to see those people again, you know, but they each, when he's like, kick off your shoes and kick off your sandals, some are wearing espadrilles and some are wearing sort of slides. And it's just like, it's literally a split second of a shot, but they showed it. And they showed it for a reason. They showed it for a reason to show that these guys are not wearing combat boots. These guys were ripped off the streets for like no reason, and put into indentured servitude by an empire. And in a lot of ways, this episode is the most effective depiction of the autocratic power of the empire and the fear that you would have living underneath the yoke of this thing. It's scarier than watching Alderaan blow up. It's scarier than like the Death Star in some ways, because it's like the fear that Cassian has when he's like,
yeah,
in line in his first days, and he's just like, what the fuck am I doing here? And how the fuck did this happen? And it's just all of a sudden, it's a Kafka story where it's just like you get pulled off the street, you get put into this white factory where you're building probably the Death Star, as many people have speculated. And you're just like, or they could be building nothing at all. You know,
or they're building everything, because this is the first show in the history of this franchise to consider. If
how did this shit get made?
Yeah. A galaxy, you need a lot of shit.
Yeah.
And the scope of it, where Cyril is working, it goes on forever. There are desks after desks after desks. There's so much of all of it.
What is like, that's the fuel usage department?
Fuel efficiency, whatever. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. There's a scope here that is staggering and yet somehow also extremely localizing and humanizing. I love that you said that it's scarier than the Death Star, because I agree. I was really uncomfortable and worried in the beginning of this episode.
Yeah.
And it's a testament to Diego Luna's performance. He has very little dialogue. It's all played on his face. But again, it's one extra decision. It's one extra choice. And it's Cassian is a rebel from the moment we meet him, whether he knows it or not, or whether it's designated as such. He has killed very early on in the show. He has taken, you know, he was a key player in one of the inciting events of this revolution. He's a wanted man. That's not why his life is being taken from him. His life is being taken from him because he was literally in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it's gone.
Yeah.
All of it is gone. And that is a incredibly, it's a very visceral choice, one that works for the character, works for the show, and it works for the larger project of this, right? That it's not, we're not trying to defeat the Empire because Darth Vader was a bad dad. We're trying to overthrow an absolutely corrosive and impenetrable fascist system that is choking the life out of everyone and everything. Yeah. And that is not changing the fundamental DNA of Star Wars, but it is approaching it from a completely different place. And it's so welcome.
So this episode was able to do a bunch of different things in one. It can do dystopian sci-fi prison life. It has an albeit brief, but deeply moving and also gorgeously shot scene between Vel and Cinta that then culminates with this dissolve of Vel leaving Ferrix, and Cinta's face is just in the window because they're, as they are like kind of dissolving away from the scene. And then you've got the kind of political intrigue of the Mon Mothma stuff. And then finally, you know, you get Stellan Skarsgård and Forrest Whitaker to sit in a cave together. I'll run that thing back 5 or 6 times, but the stuff that they're talking about in that, where it's like, he is essentially planning false flag operations. I mean, yes, these have like sort of political or military, these targets mm-hmm. have political and military value, but what he wants is to exact the most amount of like destruction on the Empire to bring down an oppressive response so that people rebel, because people need to be cajoled into doing this. And that's where you get into the real Le Carre stuff of like, we're going to start doing things that just set off a chain of events that then get us our desired result.
Also, you have a structure created here by Tony that gives us what we've been asking for when we say, okay, you destroyed Sokovia, but what is Sokovia? We don't get it, right? We have both sides of that argument here. We are in the room with Luthen as he's saying, it hasn't gotten gnarly enough, right? And then we are with Cassian in the factory where all of these, I don't know if they're helpless, if they're hapless, if they're innocent, whatever, just individuals who are being crushed because of it.
Yeah.
This factory, every detail has been considered. Everyone's action, everyone's movement. I've never seen anything like this floor, you know, and how horrifying that is. There are no doors on the cells because of the floors.
9th or 10th or 11th idea in this show that could have just been a show.
Yes. Yes. With a whole new cast of characters.
Well, we can wrap it up there. Okay.
How many squids would you want in your champagne?
Oh, I don't do that anymore. I love when they were in the mention. Is that supposed to be like, it gives you a little bit of like a high or something like that? Or a dizzy, like absinthe kind of thing?
Or isn't, I think there's an implied line that it's like gross and that's the point. That their planet tradition, the traditions on their homeworld isn't just to drop living squids into your alcoholic beverages. It's to marry at 15. You know, just all of these things that are baked into who they are that informs the choices the actors are making and the way we're perceiving the show. We get Fiona Shaw again. You know, we get, I didn't think we'd go back to Ferrix.
Yeah, I didn't think that they were, I thought that this show was always going to be like, this is this guy's trajectory through the sort of galaxy. And instead, I think it very expertly is like, Bix is important, you know, and keep Bix in mind and keep in mind what happened to Bix on Ferrix going forward, you know, and to go back to that, you know, the radio tower or whatever is really, really fascinating.
Being left behind isn't being saved. You know, no one isn't complicit in this, which is fascinating to watch. I also think that someone smarter than I am should just kind of do a tutorial on how to introduce and create a villain, because Denise Koff is just God tier. She's so good. And remember how we met her? We met her context free. You know, we know those white rooms and we know the Empire are bad, but we were on her side.
Oh, yeah.
Because she was getting kind of shit on and she was being misunderstood and she's good at her job and not being appreciated. And then she walks into the room to torture Bix. And we're like, wait, I was rooting for this person, or I'm interested in this person. It's so much more complex. There's so much more detailed. Like, when I say complex, I don't mean it's like confusing or challenging or hard. It's just you lay the groundwork. There's so much work done ahead of time to get us to this point.
And it goes back to the sort of the sort of vision of the Empire as this massive corporation that's making things and then needs to keep track of those things. Like, what's the motivating? what's motivating Dedra is she is tracking stolen stuff.
I forgot this is Star Wars, so it's Dedra, right? I just thought that was the British way of saying Deirdre.
Oh, I think it's Dedra. I mean, I think it's Dedra, but I don't think it matters.
You spend more time in the UK than I do, so I'm going to defer to you.
That's true.
On that, it's really true. It's just cool. It's just, I want this. I really just hope that James Gunn is watching this show. Let me bring it full circle. I hope Kevin Feige's watching this show, not because we need a Tony Gilroy style Andor show on the margins of those universes, although that would be awesome. Look at it just from the ambition and the imagination and the design. It's just showing me things I haven't seen before. And that's,
to your point, also, I know that it doesn't matter ultimately now that it's like signed, sealed, and paid for, but like I do think that this is a show that will have a second life once the season's over.
Do you want different iterations of silver CGI space dogs menacing your heroes as has defined the last 3 years of Marvel movies?
Or do you want to find out that hell is an Amazon warehouse?
Yes.
Yeah.
The tubes of prisoners, just that shot of all the people in the hallways trying to communicate isolated like that. That is a beautiful image. And it's a haunting image and it's a grounding image, even though it's a made up picture from space. This should be a model, not to tell this kind of story, but how to make broadly these IP stories richer and better.
Yeah.
It just is. It's awesome.
All right, Andy, we're going to wrap it up there. It's great talking to you. We're produced by Kaya McMullen as always, and we'll be back on Monday talking about White Lotus. So I can't wait to do that.
Anybody has any follow-ups, just poke me on FB.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.